Music has the power to touch us deeply. It can evoke worship, deep emotions, a sense of identity and belonging. It can bring to mind memories of past encounters with God or in church. And it also allows us to encounter God in our community in new ways. This is what makes choosing songs and hymns for worship such an important, powerful, and potentially controversial issue. As we joke, if you want to upset people in church, mess about with the songs we do in worship. Each week, Roots offers you a selection of song suggestions, from contemporary worship songs suggested alongside our children and youth resources, to hymns and songs suggested alongside our adult knowledge content. Today, I'm speaking with Gillian Warson, who chooses the hymns and songs for our adult knowledge resource. Today, we discuss the power of hymns, old and new, her process of choosing these songs, and what we can learn about choosing songs for worship. She's a professional musician playing and teaching the viola, as well as working for the Pratt Green Trust, an organisation that promotes the development of hymnody. Thanks for joining us for the Roots podcast. Here we go. Hello, Gillian.
Hello, Melanie. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's lovely to be here. We're in Oxfordshire and a beautiful house, Stanton House, where we've just had a writing conference. And we're here today to discuss church worship, hymns, songs, and all the interesting ins and outs around that. This is one of your particular passions, isn't it?
Yes, I love singing hymns. I love singing church music. I love all forms of church music, from the oldest Hildegard of Bingham to the newly, freshly minted hymns and songs that might be ready for us to sing on Sunday.
Oh, it's fantastic. Your enthusiasm is very contagious. I guess I want to start us with, why hymns? Why still hymns? You don't hear them on the radio, but a lot of churches sing hymns. So why hymns?
So hymns have been with us for a long, long time. The Bible tells us to sing hymns in praise. The early churches worked with hymns. Hymns have been the backbone of the Reformation, of changing hymns, of changing landscapes, of changing communities. And I think generally, hymns have a lot to tell us, however old they are, whether they're 400 years old or whether they're a week old. We can still learn plenty from hymns.
And let's talk a little bit about language. So what would you say is the difference between a hymn or a song, or some people would call them a chorus or a praise song? There's lots of different music that we use in church. And can you just define some of this language for us?
Well, I would define a hymn as being something in verses, and maybe many verses, maybe as you get to the end of the service and you really want to get home to your lunch and your eye casts down and there's still another five solid verses to go and your heart sings. But that gives you a chance, as you're singing these longer hymns, to work out things. They go from a journey. There's often a journey involved in hymns. A worship song might be something that's perhaps a little bit shorter, maybe with a refrain or a chorus that's easy to join into. And then you have the much shorter things, worship songs, things from Tese, for example, very simple to learn, often in different languages, but easy to pick up and very lovely to accompany, maybe something you can put into an intercession. Many songs, shorter songs, come out of the Iona community. And we do see a lot of world music coming into shorter songs. So I think the broadest way that I would define is a song is something that's perhaps a little bit easier to learn with a chorus. A hymn, while it might be easier to learn, is something that's got more intellectual challenge in terms of working through an argument or working through a debate or a discussion, often going from the beginning of a despair, for example, rather like Psalms, and coming through triumphant in glory at the end. This is not exclusive, and I'm sure all of your listeners will be phoning up and saying, oh, but what about so-and-so and so-and-so? But that's just the broad definition that I use.
Well, it makes a lot of sense. I never thought of a hymn as being a sort of an argument, as it were. But it often is. It takes you on a journey of, it's like an essay.
Yes,
here's my premise, and here's all the different ways you can see this working out.
And here I am at the end.
At the end, yes, exactly. And often there's a lot of humility in a hymn. So if you take a very old hymn, like When I Survey the Wondrous Cross, you start off with this standing at the foot of the cross, and then you end at the end with the whole world of nature mine. And so it's expanded from you being alone at the foot of the cross to then including the whole of the world. And a modern hymn writer, contemporary hymn writer who does that a lot is Timothy Dudley Smith. You look through his, he does a lot of opening up, opening out, opening out. And praise often comes at the end.
It's fascinating. So on this theme of language, we've talked about what we call these songs or hymns that we're singing. But as you said, quite a lot of these hymns that are familiar to us are rather old. And perhaps the language that they use is perhaps archaic or old-fashioned, or maybe even has things that we're not as comfortable with now. So there might be struggles with sort of disability theology, or even just it's always talking about men, or it's always talking about agricultural themes. And we live in a city and we don't farm the fields. So how what do we do with language in hymns that feels old-fashioned?
It's a very difficult topic, and one that I've written about, as indeed have many other people written about. We need to keep responsive, and we need to keep listening, and we need to keep thinking. I think also it's fair to say that we do need to give a bit of responsibility and credit to our hymn book editors, who do look at matters such as gender inclusivity, imperialism, and the idea of Britannia rules the waves is clearly no longer acceptable in hymns. And if we are using an older hymn book, which I know that many congregations do, it is perhaps worth reading through to see whether you are happy singing all of these words. The point about gender is very difficult, and a lot of contemporary hymn writers, particularly people like Brian Wren and Elizabeth Cosnett, rewrite a lot of their hymns in the light of their new theology. But if you look at older hymns, some of them are, there's one, I've forgotten what it is now, but anyway, it seems to imply that women are chattels. Women are reduced to, it'll come to me later on, women are reduced to chattels and owned by their husbands. Well, of course, we're not going to sing that now. Unfortunately, that particular hymn is very beloved because of the cultural importance and the language. So we need to really look at these things. Sometimes it's possible just simply to not have the line. And the really prime example of that, of course, is All Things Bright and Beautiful, with the line, the rich man and his castle, the poor man at his gate, which hasn't been in hymn books now for many, many years. But then there are other things in All Things Bright and Beautiful that make it difficult to sing, particularly things like Gathering the Rushes. When was the last time you were out gathering?
I don't even know if I would know what that was when I find the rush.
It's interesting, this idea about hymn singing to do with city and to do with the countryside, because in fact there are quite a few city-based hymns. Fred Kahn, writing back in the early 70s, late 60s, he was one of the first people to mention Council Flat. But of course, even Charles Wesley wrote about the effects of the mills. And of course, we've got Jerusalem, we've got Did Those Feet in Ancient Times, I Will Not Cease Till England's Green and Pleasant Lands. Okay, the language may be archaic, but the sentiment of getting rid of the misery of industrial life is important. Agriculture has changed a lot. And every harvest, we have a harvest festival when people bring in their produce. And they may be happy, some congregations may be happy to sing Bringing in the Sheaves. But of course, we don't really bring in the sheaves anymore. We bring in a few tins to give to the local food bank. But there are hymns, there are some quite unusual children's hymns that do look at agriculture in a different way. But Fred Pratt Green's hymn, For the Fruits of His Creation, that looks much more at it, the life post-industrial, really. And I think I don't know, maybe people really want to hold on to the idea that there is a beauty in agriculture. So we can still plough the fields and scatter, and we can still have a harvest home. And maybe that's what people like.
It's a common theme in scripture.
Yes.
I mean, Jesus often talks about planting and watering and sowing the seeds. And even if we are not farmers in our day by day, most of us have a garden or a window box where we plant a few seeds and try to keep some kitchen herbs alive for a few weeks. And I think we understand that idea of growth and nurture and seasons, and it is throughout scripture. So I'm not saying that we shouldn't sing songs about agricultural, but sometimes these concepts of, as you say, bringing in the sheaves, there are foreign phrases for most of us, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't sing them.
Yeah.
They're part of our cultural identity and even identity as Christians.
Yeah, and also the idea of the harvest, the workers. The harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. That's all of the harvest hymns, almost without exception, come back to the idea that the harvest is not only the harvest of the fields, but the harvest of humanity in the service of God. Mm. So I think there is definitely plenty to be said and plenty to be sung.
No, that's really good. One of the things you mentioned a moment ago was about children's hymns. And I want to sort of pick your brains about how do we, in our corporate worship together, we're singing together, how do we include children and young people in our songs? Are there songs that feel inappropriate for children? Or do we just raise them up to sing hymns alongside us? What do you think about that?
I think children enjoy singing older hymns much more than we think they do. I think it's very easy to be very condescending when it comes to children's hymns. And because we have sung, for example, Away in a Manger, we may have sung it every Christmas for 60 years. So we might think it's a very old hymn and it's a very old-fashioned hymn. Certainly it's old. But these children may be singing it for the very first time. And so is it fair to deprive them of singing something that we did enjoy singing when we were five as well? So I think that's one thing. Another thing is it's easy to think that just because a hymn or a song is fast, children will like it, or because it's loud, children will like it. And they don't always like singing loud, fast things. One thing they certainly don't always like is actions. And it's very easy to say, come up to the front and we'll do some actions. No, let's not do that. I don't go to the front and sing action songs. So, and I think that's a really careful to keep things really quite quiet. Children, particularly little children, they're quite frightened when you hear, or startled, I should say. If you play loud music, they don't always like it. It can be too loud for them. I think some of the imagery in children's hymns can be quite facile these days. But that's not to say that I would advocate going back to singing some of the 18th century hymns where it's all about be really, really good because you'll certainly die and then what will happen to your soul. So I'm not advocating going back to that. So once more, I think it's really looking and seeing what children you've got. If you have a really thriving Sunday school, a really thriving youth church, then I think it is worth hunting around, and there are some great examples of books. Some of them are quite old now, really good songs for churches. That's a good one. And also the kids' source books. But even going back, Junior Praise, they've got lovely collections of songs. And I don't think you should shy away from singing older words, provided, going back to our early part in the conversation, that the sentiments are something you would like to pass on. If you're happy singing with it and it's your sentiment and it's something that you're happy to sing with your heart, then you can pass it on to your children.
And I think, you know, it's all about creating a frame around these things, contextualizing. I think explaining words, quite often when you explain things to the children, there's plenty of adults in the back going, oh, I'd always wondered about what that meant.
Yes.
And, you know, we sing a worship song called The Lion and the Lamb. And yeah. And if you're brand new to church, you're like, who? What? What animals? What are we on about?
Yeah.
And why are we singing this? And so I think, you know, even just Christian language needs explaining. And some hymns have Christian language, and it's just a really good opportunity to say, oh, in verse two, this comes up and this is what it refers to.
Can I give you a good example of that? When I was very little, there's the line in the hymn, whose strong hands were skilled at the plane and the lathe, laudable hopefulness, Lord, for joy. And I remember saying to my mum, what does it mean, the plane and the lathe? But of course, it was referring to Jesus' skill as a carpenter. And my mum said, oh, that's because it shows that Jesus was a working man. And I hadn't really thought about that. My mum was not really particularly a Christian, but she had just knew a lot about language and knew a lot about words. She knew I liked that hymn. So that's how she explained it. And I always remember her saying that, and always remember being grateful that she explained Jesus as a working man. So, and that's quite an old hymn now. So, but it's still relevant and lovely for me to have that image of Jesus working.
Yeah. And it just, poetry and music often allow you to see different aspects of God or different aspects of faith that you wouldn't look at in the same light. That's the joy of poetry, is it comes at you in a different way.
Yes.
And so these hymn writers are helping us to see Jesus in different lights.
Yes, and there's the lovely hymn by Cooper, Sometimes the Light Surprises. And it's such a beautiful hymn. I try and choose that for Roots at least once in the series that I'm doing. It's so wonderful to have a light, the idea of a light surprising.
That's great. So what we haven't actually talked about is, how did you get into hymns? I've heard you mention that you were interested in them as a child, but what's your history with sung worship, with church music and hymns?
Well, I was really lucky. I sang in a beautiful church choir, obviously quite a formal, it's a robed choir in an Anglican church in Nebworth in Hertfordshire, the lovely choir master Malcolm Hicks. Although it was quite formal, the church was surprisingly forward-looking and introduced very quickly 100 Hymns for Today, which was a supplement to Hymns Ancient and Modern. So I was singing hymns by hymn writers who were then, this was back in the late 60s, early 70s, who were alive. And that was a real revelation to think, oh, hymn writers are actually alive. When I was at school, I went to a school that had a lot of music. We sang out of the Faith Folk books. Don't know whether you know those, Faith Folk and Festivity, Faith Folk and Charity. Of course, the Sidney Carter ones, Crow in the Cradle, and they were new. They were new then. So that was very exciting. And then I realised quite young that new was as good as old. Old is good, but new is good too. And I was lucky to be introduced to the first praise and worship books like Sounds of Living Waters, Fresh Sounds, lovely hymns, and also and psalms. There was a wonderful music sort of happening, which was called Come Together. And the Owens, Carol Owens and Jimmy Owens were the writers of that. And it sort of toured the area. So, and that had songs that we still sing now. So I was always singing up to the minute, as it were. And so the praise and worship ones came on, then Mission Praise came in. The first Graham Kendricks became very, very popular when I was having my own children, and then gradually just moved on with that. So I was keeping the old running along, enjoying singing older hymns, but loving singing new ones as well.
Mm-hmm. That's fantastic. So one of your roles for Roots is that you help choose the hymns and songs that we suggest each week. Can you tell us a bit of your process of how you choose them, why you choose them?
Well, it takes me a long time to choose them. I start by looking at the themes. So I look at the Bible passage, which is highlighted. It's often the gospel, as you know, but not always. So I will look and I will see what comes out of that. Then Tracy, the editor, sends me a list of other themes that might be in, so I'll have a quick look through that. And then I start the process of rooting through what I can actually find. And I look on I look through my hymn book collection, which, as you can imagine, is vast. I've got a whole library of hymn books. I also look on internet searches. I use particularly HymnQuest, which has many, many hymns listed. And also the benefit of looking on HymnQuest is it will tell you what hymn book the text is in or the hymn is in. So I will know if it's available. If it's not available in any published hymn books, then I'm reluctant to choose it. I also look on a resource called Song Select, which lists many, many hymns. There are some shortcomings to Song Select, and that is it does not have many foreign language text on it, and I do like to choose some foreign language texts, particularly the shorter ones, just to sort of ring the differences. But there are other searches available. Singing the Faith's got a good source, Jubilate's got a good source, Praise's got a good source. So I look through and I see what's going to be available. Sometimes I'll go quite off the wall and think, oh, I really like that. I'll maybe pick something that's like a protest song, Blowing in the Wind, for example, and then I'll have to find a YouTube clip to put in. So I try to look across the spectrum and I try to think to myself, how many people will be able to access these? And one of the things that we've talked about is choosing a really new hymn. So if there's a theme that deals particularly maybe, for example, with homelessness, with childlessness, with divorce, with separation, there may be a brand new hymn about that. If I want to choose that hymn, I will try to make sure that I can find a tune that fits it and that on a list such as Hymn Quest or Song Select, it will have a tune that is well known so that that can be accessed easily by a number of people.
Mm. And that's a really key thing of how do you introduce new music without overwhelming your congregation? We were joking earlier that one of the quick ways to upset people is to change the music, because music is a way that we express identity. It goes straight to our heart. It bypasses our brains in some ways. And we have strong, visceral, emotional reactions to songs, positive or negative, you know, and so when we introduce new things, people can have strong reactions.
Very strong reactions. And one of the difficulties is if you're a visiting preacher, like I am, if you choose a hymn, but you use a different tune to the one that the established congregation has got, then that can easily ruffle a few feathers. Usually I manage to talk down the situation or change the tune. It is hard introducing new things. There are several ways that I go about it. And one is I make sure that I often have a dual role when I lead the music. When I'm at a church, I lead the music and I take the whole service. So I'm leaping backwards and forwards to pick up instruments. But I play, if I want to do a new hymn, I'll play it several times before the service. I'll sing it sometime during the service, and then perhaps at the end of the sermon, I'll come back to it or sing it again at the end. So people have got a feeling for a new hymn, and quite often they do say to me at the end, I like that new hymn, we'll use it again. So I think that's a plus for me there.
Yeah, so it's repetition and allowing people to slowly it sinks into our subconscious if you're playing it at the beginning, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think also the other thing about being a worship leader is the worship leader is not the enemy. The worship leader is there as an enabler and as an assister. And I think it's really important for worship leaders and ministerial teams to work together. And it's quite easy for either faction to be quite precious about what they want to achieve. But in the end, we all want to achieve the same thing. We all want to praise. We all want to share the word of God. And we all want to take that Christian message out into our lives. And if we start bickering in church about what hymn we're going to sing or what tune we're going to sing, it's not a good start.
No, it's not, is it? It isn't. But I do think it comes back to that. This is important. It is evocative. It is powerful. And worship is something we're all called to. And of course, music, sung worship, is not the only way we worship. I think you've got a fun story about that.
So... Yes, yeah, so one of the former Archbishops of Canterbury, Archbishop Rowan Williams, he went into church when he was in parish ministry, and he, for one reason or another, his worship group were not available. And so he said, he was explaining this, and somebody went up to him and said, oh, so we're not having worship today. And of course, he had to point out to this congregation member that singing is only one of our sorts of worship. So, and I think it's really important to remember, that's another thing that I try to bear in mind when I'm choosing the words. We may sing a song that takes us way out of the pew, beyond the church doors, to take the message and say, what now? And there's lots of close of worship songs and hymns that you can take, and you think, yes, I can sing that. I can sing that. That's how I can take the message out. Well-known ones like You Shall Go Out With Joy. Lovely, lovely, bright song to take out beyond the church doors. And then there's Go Forth and Tell, and We Have a Gospel to Proclaim. They're all songs that take us beyond the church. And so worship is, it's for our daily lives. Worship is for our daily lives and not just for Sundays.
No, indeed. I do love it when, you know, you catch your children humming along a little worship song later, even if they've not got all the words. It's that it's embedded in our psyche, or driving along and just a hymn pops into mind and you end up singing it in the week. Yeah. Because it's that sense of it's coming back to you, and that commitment, or that, as you say, the essay I sort of sung in worship through this hymn, or the familiarity of something from your childhood in church, it comes again to you and you are in the presence of God singing on your own. But there's also something about the togetherness that we have of corporate singing and all of us together articulating these points of faith.
You can be doing everyday things like cycling, and a hymn will come into your mind. I remember being out on my bike quite recently, there was a lovely fragrance in the air, and that lovely old hymn, "Whence Is That Goodly Fragrance Flowing?" I think that was part of it, and then your heart starts to sing with it. So there's all sorts of things, and sometimes it will just lift your spirits, as you say, if a song comes into your head. Oh, I love that one. I'll sing along.
It's beautiful. So tell us more about HymnQuest and the Pratt Green Trust. You're involved with the Pratt Green Trust. Who are they? What is this, and how do they support hymns?
So the Pratt Green Trust, there's two things there. The Pratt Green Trust is in its 40th anniversary year. So it's a trust, and the funding for the trust comes from the royalties of the hymn writer Fred Pratt Green, who was a very influential hymn writer in the 60s, and he had no children, no family, so he generously gave all the royalties, which obviously keep on coming in, to the furtherment of hymnody in its broadest sense. So what the trust does, it administers this estate to give funding for projects to do with hymnody. So this could be anything. It could be running a festival. So Cheltenham Christian Arts Festival had some funding from us. It could be for training church musicians. So Bury St Edmunds Cathedral and the RSCM have had more funding for more formal projects to do with organ playing. It could be to do with study. So a music minister might want to improve their studies and gain higher qualifications. It might be towards that. Somebody may want to publish a book, which I did last year, and bring together some resources, so give funding for that. So there are lots of different ways that you can apply to the Pratt Green Trust for funding. HymnQuest is part of that legacy. So we do fund HymnQuest, which is administered by the publishing house at Steiner and Bell. And that is one of the most lasting legacies. So HymnQuest, it is a subscription service up to a point, but you can access it free. You can look at it free, but you can't do all the downloading and printing off for free, but you can access and search it for free. And as I said earlier, it's a really good way of finding your full texts. And what hymn book they're in. So one of the things that we're doing for the Pratt Green Trust is we're running a hymn competition this year to celebrate. We're going to do an academic seminar later on. And it's to do with making hymns, both old historical hymns and new hymns, newly, freshly minted hymns that aren't even written yet, will come in and we want to make them excellent. Oh, we've got some wonderful trustees. Most of our trustees are hymn writers. We've got Andrew Pratt is a hymn writer, Janet Wootton, and of course, Bernadette Farrell, who's a really fantastic hymn writer, is one of our writers and our trustees. So it's a really exciting trust to be part of. And I praise the Lord daily that I've managed to find a job that is what I love.
Yeah, it's a real gift, isn't it? To be able to do what you love and serve God doing it. Yes, amen. May we all find things like that. Amazing. And I can see in your hands you've got some books. Have you got some recommendations on books that people can read and explore to grow in their appreciation of hymns or in their way that they lead worship?
Well, the best book that I've read lately about hymns and establishing a church music group and church music in a church that did not have any is a book called The Resounding Body, and it's by Andy Thomas and it's published by Sacristy Press, and the subtitle is Building Christ-like Church Communities Through Music. And it's a lovely exploration of building music from the ground up. This was a church that had nothing and then went on to have wonderful flourishing relationships, not only through music, but it started with music, then went on to be very across the whole of the worshipping body. So that's a really good book, nice and easy to read. And then I have two books by my own good self. Mm-hmm. One is called Using Vintage Hymns in Worship, and the subtitle is Hidden Treasures Rediscovered for Today's Church. And although it's got vintage hymns in the title, it's not really about vintage hymns. It's about hymns change and how we can enjoy old texts, but freshen them up maybe by changing the language, changing the tune. It's about different trends in hymn writing and by looking at all the things that are happening in our church music. And the last book I've got here is called First Flight Feathers, which is a lovely title, although difficult to say. And it's called First Flight Feathers, The Best of Worship Live. And it's an edited selection of texts, which I edited along with my friend and colleague, Janet Wootton. And it's a compilation of items from Worship Live, which was a publication that ceased to exist about 10 years ago. But much of the material was so good and so lovely that we decided that we would put this together. So all three of these are published by Sacristy Press and are available through their website.
So tell me more about First Flight Feathers. It is difficult to say. I hear what you mean. Is it hymn lyrics or is it articles about hymns or is it about worship leading?
It is a collection of hymn lyrics, some with original tunes, some not. But it's got a lot of editorial stuff. So it tells a little story about most of the texts. And it's incredible about the community that came to build this selection. So there's some people that wrote the tune and then somebody put some words to go with the tune, or somebody wrote some words and then somebody put a tune with it. So it's about the community of hymn writing and the acting of offering this sort of raw material of hymns, offering them to congregations. Some of them were sung in all sorts of different places, small churches, big churches. Some of them are competition winners. And there's some lovely, lovely imagery in it. And all of them, as I say, have got a little tiny story with them. So they've all got something to offer. I think they're lovely.
I love a story about how a song was written. I did an MBA in music industry, music business. And one of the things they talked about was that the way that you sell music is not just by producing a beautiful song, but that there's the story behind the song, which is why we love these programs where we watch pop stars become pop stars, because we're on the journey with them and there's a bit of story and it sells music. But I think also for worship music, to know the story behind the poetry, to know the story behind the composer or the author, it's you've gone on their journey of worship with them and it invites us in. And I just think this really precious to be able to hear that.
Yeah, and I think that's true. And also another thing about First Flight Feathers is it's got hymns by all sorts of different people. I mean, it's just dropped out open here at number 83, which is a song that was written in a harvest. Interesting, because we talked about that. A harvest festival at a school. And it talks all about the things that we love, like raspberries. But then it goes on about how we've got to grow it ourselves and nurture it ourselves. So it's a lovely story that children have written. And there's a couple of texts about more unusual people in the Bible, people that don't get much of a look in the Bible, like Simwi prays for Hebrew midwives, all sorts of different songs. So I think it's a lovely collection to look at things afresh, look at something new, think about a new way of doing things. So I would look at it.
Thank you. Obviously, your song choices each week in Roots magazine is such an aid to worship leaders around the country, being able to filter through, as you say, the thousands and thousands of possible hymns to a smaller selection that is chosen to match the lectionary readings and the themes that we've gone for. But also, I just think through this conversation, the provocation to marry the old and the new, and to take what we've inherited, but also to make sure it still resonates, make sure the language still resonates. But I do think there is an identity that is formed in the songs that we sing. And it's really, really key.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for sharing your wisdom.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Roots for Churches podcast. Discover all our resources to support you in preaching, worship, youth, children, and intergenerational ministry on our website, rootsforchurches.com.